I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Low-wage workers are often just one crisis away from extreme poverty. At America's Family, Steve Biggory recruits employers to take a lead role in addressing the problems that make their workers vulnerable. He's working to break the cycle of persistent poverty by helping workers achieve personal stability and to develop the skills they need to get a foothold on the ladder to the middle class. Steve is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us is Lance Borelowitz, author of Dream City, Vancouver, and the Global Imagination. We'll find out from Lance why Vancouver seems to be every urban planner's favorite North American city. All that and more on today's Smart City, but first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. As a McDonald's franchisee, Steve Biggory saw how common problems frequently made it difficult for low-wage workers to do their jobs. A sick child or a car that malfunctions, which would barely disturb a higher-wage worker, can be a huge setback for working-class families. So Steve formed America's Family. Steve, you were a McDonald's franchisee. You owned 12 restaurants. What drew you into nonprofit work and the founding of America's Family?
You know, Carol, that's an interesting question because I was kind of just foisted into it. The marketplace brought me into it. I saw such tremendous need in my employees, and I was able to really see a way to bring the entire community together to help those folks. So what grew out of that was America's Family, a very unique model of engaging the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, all in their own vested self-interest to accomplish what they needed to do. And especially, I think, and most importantly, it features the employer at the center because the employer has a unique relationship of trust with the employee, and we're able to utilize that relationship to help the individual break out of poverty.
Describe the work of America's Family.
We're like a giant transmission is the best way I can describe us. We really help the three sectors spin together uniformly and all helping the individual. So we're a great instrument of collaboration. We take all the great service providers. Here in Colorado Springs, there are 804 great service providers. We work with most of them to help bring just the right help to an individual at just the right time.
Steve, you were a fast food franchisee, and your employees, as you say, were not making enough money. Their incomes were not big enough or stable enough for them to have the security they needed. So I have to ask the question, why not just pay a living wage?
That's an excellent question. It's a marketplace question. It's easy to vilify employers and brands. You know, there are 39 million working poor individuals in America, Carol, and McDonald's and Walmart together only employ less than 2 million people. So what we have is a systemic economic problem. You might point the finger back at yourself, or I might point it back at myself as a consumer, because if we were willing to pay what these goods and services were worth, then employers would be able to pay folks a living wage. But, you know, they're not, and you have to deal with that economic reality. And so rather than try to create an artificial system where you say, hey, employer, just pay them more, which is going to destroy the employer's margins and put them out of business, that's not free enterprise. We're very much in tune with a free enterprise model where we know how to get people out of poverty. It's through education and relationships. All the work points to those two things. And so what you have to do is deal with where the employee is today and help them just really navigate the difficulties of life so that if they want to, they can work their way through those problems.
Well, I think you point to two very important things, and education is typically a public good. It's paid for by public funds. Connections are something else again, and I think I agree with you. They're highly valuable. But certainly Our economic system, the way it works, and when you have 39 million working poor, you're certainly shifting cost from the employer to the public, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, any number of things. Certainly healthcare falls into that category. How do you, as head of America's Family, think about that? Because I know it's very hard for a fast food franchisee, for instance, to be providing health insurance for its workers and remain competitive in terms of the prices of its products.
Well, Carol, let me give you a great example of that. There's a wonderful federal program called CHIP Plus that pays for health insurance of the children of all the underserved in America. And yet they have never spent all the money that's available. So really what we have in healthcare, there are so many issues with healthcare, but there are two I'd really like to highlight. The first one is those children. There is no reason why any child in America would ever go without health coverage, because there's plenty of coverage available. There's plenty of money. If they spent all the money, great charities like Robert Wood Johnson Foundation have contingency funds for that eventuality, but they never have. The problem is we can't find the poor kids. So the employers of these folks can help. And if you think about the impact of not having adequate health care and not being able to get those kids taken care of, that affects the low-wage earner as well. Let me give you an example. I have an employee that went through this, and it reaches into all aspects of her life. So she had a difficult time getting her kids immunized because she was constantly moving. The car would break down. The kids would get sick. So she moved four times in a period of 2 years. Well, it takes about 2 years to go through an immunization cycle. So she couldn't finish that work. She loves her kids just like you and I do, but she was unable to get that done. So as a consequence of that, the child then gets sick. And every day she misses at work is a 20% pay cut. So the best thing we can do for her is to help her kids stay well, to help manage all the other issues in her life so that she can stay at work. And you have to remember, an entry-level job shouldn't be a career. It should be a beginning. So in the short term, we lever those public funds, nonprofit funds, and all the great people like the community health center infrastructure. There are over 900 of those in America, and they are wonderful outfits. Now, there's all new private sector initiatives in healthcare that are reducing costs and improving access. We help bring all those to the individual so that they can focus on getting well in their life and graduating to a job where they can. The economic reality of it is it will allow them to get healthcare.
All right. Explain the model here, Steve. What do you expect the employer to provide in this model that America's Family has developed? What do you expect social service agencies to provide, and what do you expect government to provide?
We expect everyone to do exactly what they do today. We just make them more efficient. If you think of it as a distribution mechanism, we're like a giant power cord that connects everybody together. So the key is for the employer, the access. No one knows when a single mom is going to call out sick except that supervisor. So when that supervisor calls, we point them in the direction that they need to go to solve the problem. So, for instance, the supervisor only needs to know that 211, a wonderful program started by United Way, is available in the community. So when that employee calls in and says, I can't make it in, all the supervisor, the employer, has to know is to ask why. Why can't you make it in? Well, because X. Well, let me point you to the place where you can go to get help. That stabilizes them. So that's the first phase of the program, and that's really where we focus. Next, there are four federal programs that are available to these folks that can help stabilize their income, but they don't know about them. In fact, fewer than 7% of those folks in America that are eligible for all four get them. One of those programs, the Advanced Earned Income Tax Credit, gets them $2,700. Now, I'm not saying they should be on that credit forever. I'm saying that that credit is there to help them navigate their way out of poverty. The next thing we do is try to control their spending. And we've got some really novel approaches to that. We're getting into the payday lending business. And we're going to, you know, there are 30,000 pawn shops in America, 22,000 payday lending places. And it is one of the fastest growing industries in America. And some of these folks are charging 1,500%. And we intend over the next few years to put many of those folks out of business. And then finally, we connect them to the education infrastructures of this country so that they can get an education while they're working, while they're supporting their families, so that they can graduate, if it were, to jobs with benefits, higher earning potential, and just really help them achieve. The fundamental thing here is just to love people enough to help them achieve their best, their highest level of sufficiency.
You said there were four federal programs that you attempt to connect them to that help stabilize these working poor. One you mentioned was the advanced income tax credit.
Yeah, there is an earned income tax credit, and there's actually a component of that that allows them to get their money up front on payday, not at the end of the year.
And then there are three others. Name them.
WIC, TANF, and food stamps.
Okay. And WIC is?
Women's, Infants, and Children. These are all programs that come around the family. Each of them have Women's, Infants, and Children is that one. TANF is the old version of what you would know as welfare, and then food stamps. And obviously there are great distribution mechanisms. Like here in El Paso County, they have wonderful ways of distributing those resources. But the key is no one wants people to be on those forever. They're intended to be a hand up, not a hand out. And what they need to do is transition to better work, and I would say more fulfilling work. You know, I'm leaving my 18-year career as a McDonald's franchisee next month, and I would tell you that McDonald's is very passionate about its people. And, you know, we don't get up in the morning and say, you know, how can we not do better today? We get up and say, how can we do better every single day? And I think I speak for most employers in America. We're doing our best. We're working hard to make a living. But there's got to be a smarter way to accomplish this stuff.
Steve, what is it you expect or require of employees taking advantage of this new service delivery, new service mechanism? Anything other than just simply take advantage of it?
No, absolutely. We believe in a free enterprise model where they work their way out of poverty. Nobody's going to give them anything. So, for instance, when we're dealing in the emergent issues, what I would call the emergency room of life issues, my kids are sick, my car's broken down, we don't expect anything. We connect them with the wonderful people in the community that fix that because that's what they need. They need to get back to work. But when we really step into the next phase of the program, we start talking about their budget. In the payday lending part of this, without getting into too much technical detail, we basically allow them a choice. We say you can get one rate if you will accept discipline, financial accountability, electronic paydays, a budget, a mentor. If you'll do all those things, we'll give you a much better rate than if you won't. It's America. You can choose to be foolish. But we're not going to pay you to be foolish. So if you want to continue to behave badly, you'll get one level of support. If you want to change your life, we're really going to come alongside you. And finally, in the ultimate model that we're working on today, we'll network them so if they graduate from that, they'll get a free computer for their house that they can use to get an education, go online. That's one of the other big things. These folks are so busy. Many of them work in two jobs. To tell them to get an education, you might as well tell them to jump to Mars. So you have to understand what they're up against. They can sit at the kitchen table and go online and access the community college system. But to tell them to enroll at the University of Colorado or Harvard, you know, you might as well tell them to sprout wings.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Steve Biggory. He is the executive director of America's Families. How many people are you serving currently, both employers and then employees?
Well, I'd be really careful to say that we're actually serving them today because we're currently rebuilding the payday lending piece and expecting to take this nationally here next month. But roughly 7 employers, about 25,000 people that we actively administer service to.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, we are more a conduit, so we point them to other folks mm-hmm. more than a direct service provider.
Mm-hmm. Are you providing, but you are intending to provide the payday lending piece?
Yes, nationally. We're hoping, you know, as I leave McDonald's, I will fund the beta test of that with my personal funds. No bank is going to, you know, we're really talking about the front lines of entrepreneurship here. No bank is ever going to fund a program like that. They say, you want to what? You want to lend money to the highest risk people in America? And what I would tell you is that we have significant experience in this, and these folks will pay these loans back. They will be accountable, and that is going to be highly successful. You know, we've been blessed to work with great organizations like Ashoka and New Profit and Daniels and the Anschutz Foundation, and all these folks are looking for smarter ways. So we're really talking more about a model and a movement here than we are about a program.
Mm-hmm. Steve, will the payday lending, do you anticipate that that could actually fund America's family?
What a great question. You know, you can't very well expect an individual to become self-sufficient when the nonprofit that tries to get them there isn't itself. So if we're fortunate enough to raise the funds that we need to in the very near future, I believe within the next 3 years, we will be completely self-sufficient through the payday lending and pay card model. And at the same time, saving these individuals literally millions of dollars a year from the extortion that they're up against today, if that's successful, we intend to immediately move into cars because that's the other big barrier they have is transportation. They need to get to work. They need reliable cars. And in the predatory lending business, there's nothing like a chop shop car dealer to really exploit folks. Not all car dealers, please. There are great car dealers. But there's a whole subset that just feeds off of the underprivileged.
Mm-hmm. You are working with only a small number of employers now, but where have you had pushback from employers?
I think we're just leaving the laboratory is the way I best describe the phase we're in. I call it America's Family 7.0 because really the first six phases, you know, as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, it's important for me to charge those who are receiving the benefit. And employers benefit greatly from this. But we're in this interesting catch-22 time frame where employers' resources are stretched beyond their means and they don't have time. So in the earlier models, we were demanding that the employers pay for these services. And that's where we got the biggest pushback because they just don't have the time or the money to do it. So by incorporating the payday lending model, we solve first the biggest problem, the most short-term immediate problem for the employee, and simultaneously we're able to fund it. So at least in the short term, we won't be able to charge employers. As we demonstrate the value, that has been absolutely very well monitored by the University of Colorado, has studied this since almost the inception of America's Family. As we can prove that value, employers will certainly in the long term pay for these services, mm-hmm. and that'll just help them scale faster.
And so right now, if employers don't have to pay for the service, what do they have to do? In other words, communicate the availability of it, allow space on site. What do they have to do?
It's just access and training. They allow us to interact with their employees, and they tell their supervisors, when you get in trouble, call this number, see this website. And if you want to learn more about that, your guests can see it at amfol.com.
Okay. What is the killer service in the mix of social services? Which is the service that going without provides lethal to people who are poor and working?
All of them. What's unique about this and what's so difficult is that these folks are in a position where they have to live crisis to crisis. So this month, it's a sick kid. Next month, it's a blown transmission. Next month, it's my own illness. So it's really healthcare, transportation, and childcare is extremely difficult because if you don't have a safe place to leave your kids, you can't very well work.
Mm-hmm. Do you imagine unions becoming part of this mix? Could unions substitute for the employer in unionized work environments?
Certainly they could. Anyone who provides access, communication access, and a trust relationship with an employee could. And really for us, it's about engaging everyone. This isn't about promoting America's Family. I could just assume somebody else absorbs this mission because if they don't, I'm just going to be doing it for the rest of my life. It's what I was put here to do. But hopefully, if everyone gets involved, employers, employees, unions, anyone who wants whose vested self-interest lies in helping folks achieve their maximum potential. The sooner we do that, the sooner we reach a tipping point. And I can spend more time talking to folks like you than I do bending people's arms to get them to do things that they don't always want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've all read about fast food restaurants that using remote workers to take the intercom orders as you drive around in your car. Is offshoring, in your opinion, a real threat, Steve, to low-wage service workers?
No, I don't think it's a threat at all. You know, I helped pioneer the concept of the call center order-taking model in fast food, and it is really just about efficiency. It's really about excellence. It really improves the process. There's no offshoring going on today. I think it's a better opportunity. These folks, if you come and see the folks that are working in my call center today, they would tell you they're making better money. They have a better lifestyle and an opportunity now that we're networking them through the Workforce Center. Again, this is a national program, and the community colleges. If I could, let me tell you a story about a hero of mine. There's a young woman that works for me named Michelle, and I'll just tell you that her life would bring you to tears. It is one of the hardest lives that I've ever imagined. And 4 or 5 years ago, we were doing a little video talking about the concept, the notion of America's family. And her body language was her head was in her hands. And I'm slow. I really am disabled. I really, you know, am not worth much. And she couldn't even look at the camera. And now she is operating the most sophisticated restaurant technology in the world. And just a few short months ago, when the legendary coach John Wooden came to visit her and saw her working in the call center, he turned to her and said, "Hey, Michelle, what's next for you?" And she proudly looked this legend in the eyes and said, "Someday I'll own my own call center." And I just looked at her and smiled and said, "You know what? I know you will." Now think about that. That's a story of transformation. And all I want to do is help millions of other people experience what she's already done.
Can you scale this thing?
Absolutely. What we've done over the past 6 years is figure out how to let the marketplace bring this to a tipping point. And that's what we're going to spend the next few years doing. Now, the question is, you know, we're working on the funding for that. We need several million dollars. And fortunately, our good friends in Boston, New Profit, may consider us for that. If they don't, it's not a question of whether, Carol, it's a question of when. Mm-hmm. If someone steps up with a significant grant for $1 or $2 million, I think I could get this thing done. But it doesn't matter if they don't, because I'll just spend the next 30 years doing what they could get done in 3 to 5.
Tell me, Steve, what are the fundamental differences in running a for-profit business and a not-for-profit organization?
Oh, I think the outcome is different. It's so much easier in the for-profit business because you have a set of metrics that you look at every day. You have a P&L that you look at every month, and it's so much easier. Here, you're measuring your outcomes in terms of transformed lives, and it's really much harder to quantify.
Well, Steve, good luck with your work. Good luck with scaling up America's family, and thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Well, Carol, thanks so much for having me. And if you would remind your guests, amfol.com, we'd really appreciate their support. Employers, employees, we look forward to working with you.
Steve Biggory is Executive Director of America's Family. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Lance Borelowitz about Vancouver, North America's Dream City. Plus, we'll check in with Otis White to get the latest news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White joins us each week with the latest news from cities. Otis, like you, I always enjoy seeing a new report on cities, and this one comes from PricewaterhouseCoopers, the consulting firm. It's called Cities of the Future, Global Competition, Local Leadership. There's some helpful detailing of the urban assets that leaders must manage and the challenges cities face. I'm curious your reaction to the report.
Well, I thought it was largely common sense stuff presented in a new and interesting way. We do know that cities are complicated environments, and what this report sought to do was to sort of unravel those various environments and show how they work together. So they it's a financial firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, so they termed everything as capital. So there's intellectual and social capital that's important to cities, and there's democratic capital, we'd call that citizen participation. cultural capital. That's the stuff you can do in cities and how that message of all the things you can do is communicated. Environmental capital and financial capital and technical capital and so on. So they sort of set out these six forms of capital that they say are central to the way cities operate and that cities, smart cities will learn how to manage these various capitals. I think what's sort of interesting about it, aside from the dividing up of these things so it's a little bit more understandable, is how they focus, I think, correctly on the interdependence of these things. So, for instance, if people in a community begin to feel like they really are involved in decision-making, that would be democratic capital, then they would tend to attract other people who want to come to a place where they will feel valued, and that would bring some intellectual and social capital. And those kind of people are sometimes very good for building cultural capital. So if you can sort of get one of these things going, one of these capitals, and do well with them, they tend to reinforce one another, and they tend to create even more benefit. And the reverse also is true, which is when you diminish one of these capitals, you tend to diminish them all eventually. And I think that interdependence is good. The other thing that I was sort of I liked about it is that it goes back to the sort of Rosabeth Moss Cantor analogy for cities, which is that they need to be, not only do they need to be magnets, they need to be glue. That is, they need to not only attract people there, but keep them there. So it's not enough to attract just talented people, but you got to make them help. You got to help them find one another and feel like they're truly a citizen in the community and not just a person who lives there. And if you do, you'll hold on to talented people.
And this report primarily is focused on cities outside the U.S.
Yes.
Very interesting report. Thanks for bringing it to our attention, Otis. We'll talk to you next week. Otis is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Lance Borelowitz is an award-winning writer and commentator on urban planning. Educated in architecture and design, Lance has written extensively about Vancouver, including in his book Dream City, Vancouver and the Global Imagination. Lance, why do you call Vancouver the Dream City?
Well, because, as I say in the book of that title, it's like a dream. In many ways, you don't know where it's going to take you once you start giving yourself over to it. It's also a bit like a seductress or a courtesan. It's a city of desire. And so, in many ways, it allows people to play out their fantasies and project them onto the city because it's such a benign, soft, passive place. So in many ways, it's a bit like when we dream, when we go to sleep. We're not quite sure where we will wake up at the end of the dream, but it's usually, hopefully, a pleasant ride along the way. And thus far, at least, Vancouver seems to have avoided the other side of that coin, which, of course, is the nightmare.
I was in Vancouver for the first time in many years, just a couple of months ago, and came away with several impressions. First, the density is remarkable and beautiful.
Yes.
How was that achieved?
Well, over the last 20 years or so, since Expo 86, the World's Fair that was held here in central Vancouver, closed, the city's embarked on a conscious and deliberate set of policies around essentially re-densifying or re-populating the downtown peninsula. And it's basically doubled in the last 20 years from about 40,000 people living in the downtown peninsula in the mid-80s to probably close to 100,000 today. One of the reasons that happened was we had this very large piece of land that was essentially in public ownership that was brought out into the market and sold to one single developer with very deep pockets from Hong Kong, who were both able in terms of bringing capital to the project and also willing to invest in the long term and also bringing a different perspective to what was appropriate densities coming from Hong Kong, which, of course, is probably the densest city in the world. They had no compunctions about proposing some significantly higher densities than what Vancouver had had seen hitherto. And so there was a confluence of circumstance around the availability of the land, the fact that it was in single ownership, the fact that the developer who acquired it had significant resources to invest in the long term and also brought an offshore perspective that wasn't afraid of, indeed embraced density. I think those are some of the key reasons why you've seen the densification in that part of the downtown peninsula.
And that accounts for the densification, but it doesn't necessarily account for the beauty that is coupled with it. So describe how you have density plus beauty.
Well, that's a very interesting thing about Vancouver, is that we seem to have managed to have our cake and eat it because, of course, as you, I think, are alluding to, for most people in North America, density is a scary word, and it usually equates with pretty awful environments, built environments that are not beautiful. So Vancouver starts off with a huge advantage. We have a very beautiful natural geographic environment with a series of peninsulas and water bodies, with this mountain tableau on the north shore, this panorama of mountains. So right from the get-go, whatever we do kind of thing in Vancouver is as it were, nestled into a very beautiful physical context. So that really helps soften the sharp edges of some of the modern architecture and some of the frankly more banal architecture that we have plenty of in Vancouver. The other factor was that we had a very sophisticated planning regime at the City of Vancouver, which included a fairly detailed review of the design proposals as they come through in the city. And we've developed, as I say, a fairly sophisticated system whereby there is design review by peers, in other words, by other designers, architects, planners, engineers, landscape architects, who review the work of the applicant's architects and by offering them advice in a constructive, critical fashion, are able to actually fashion a better product at the end of the day. And that's relatively unusual in Canada, and it's probably very rare, I would guess, in the United States. Certainly other cities in Canada are looking to the Vancouver model of development approvals and trying to emulate it where they can. I should say, with some resistance from the development communities in other cities. So that was another reason. And the third reason, I would argue, is that we have a talent pool here of significant depth of designers and architects. I think in my book I talk about how Vancouver has the highest per capita population of architects of any city in Canada. And that's, again, partly because of the high quality of lifestyle and the desirability of living in Vancouver. And architects, after all, are most intensely aware of and concerned about their built environment and the place in which they live, and naturally will gravitate towards the higher quality environments. And so we do have a high talent pool, and to their credit, many of the initial major developers weren't shy about going to the good talent to get really good design. So I think there was a number of circumstances. And the last one I would mention is that we have developed what I would call a made-in-Vancouver solution for high-rise density, and that is very slim towers on short two- or three-story podiums. And the reason for the slimness, which adds, I think, significantly to the harmoniousness and the elegance of the high-density high-rise towers, is because of the desire to protect the views of the mountains and the water beyond. And so by having very slim, taller towers rather than fatter, squatter towers, we're actually opening up and maintaining more views between the towers, which I think also contributes to the sense of grace and elegance of the downtown skyline.
You mentioned the banal architecture, mm-hmm. and so I'll take your term and ask you why that is. Some people, I've heard friends argue that design review dumbs things down. Do you feel that that problem is a thing of the past in Vancouver, and Vancouver has moved beyond to a better architectural statement for the city? And how do you think design review contributes to making better buildings, better design?
Well, like most intelligent questions, the answer isn't black or white. I think it's shades of gray. I think there's plenty of banal architecture going on in Vancouver to this day. Certainly, when I arrived here over 20 years ago, there seemed to be a lot of banality in the built environment. Many buildings that were built very cheaply and very shoddily, and with very little expectation of having a very long lifestyle, a long lifetime, I should say. You know, we sort of built in a very transient way, and I think we allowed the spectacular setting and the mountain scenery and the ocean and so on to really kind of hide behind that and take advantage of that, and allowed us to get away with what I would describe as a mediocre architecture by and large. On the other hand, we've also had some very solid and I would say impressive recent architectural projects that have emerged in the city. And certainly taken collectively, I think the downtown skyline of high-rise residential towers is of some elegance and certainly has a certain sense of grace and beauty. And the design review process that we just talked about doesn't necessarily result in an architecture of excellence. I think the point's well taken that you can over-design things, and design by committee is always a danger, and there's that risk. It's still there, absolutely. But it very much depends on two key players, I would say, who can kind of surface and rise above that condition. One is you need an owner, the developer or the landowner, who is prepared to take some risks and has a sense of aesthetic beauty and appreciation for design excellence. And if you have a client like that, then the other player, which is the architect, needs to be a talented designer. And so, as I mentioned before, I think we have several talented designers where, when allowed to practice their profession in a creative way by their clients, the developers and the landowners, can actually produce some very stunning architecture. And I think there's several examples of buildings like that around the downtown peninsula. But that's not to say that through the design review process, there isn't always the ever-present danger of designing down, you know, design by committee, dumbing it down to the lowest common denominator. And frankly, we've seen quite a bit of that, and a significant minority, I will probably say, a significant minority of the more recent towers in downtown, I think, are relatively forgettable. They're not particularly inspiring, and they've gone through the design review process, and perhaps the combination of talent, skill, and risk-taking wasn't there on the part of the owner and the architects. And sure enough, you get a less offensive project, and I think that's perhaps the greatest merit and virtue of having the design review process that we have with an urban design panel, that we tend to identify and exclude the worst mistakes. Does that create great, brilliant architecture? Not always, unless those other factors pertain.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the slim tall towers mm-hmm. that preserve the view sheds. I also noticed that many blocks seem to have tall towers as bookends, but between those tall towers will be low-rise buildings, 3-4-story buildings. Is that a deliberate pattern, and what does that pattern achieve?
It is a deliberate pattern, Carol. We have design policy and guidelines in parts of the downtown peninsula area which say that there needs to be a minimum distance of at least 80 feet between adjacent towers, ideally more than that, up to 100 feet if we can get it. But with Vancouver's typical block size and pattern, what it usually results in, as you've just correctly identified, is towers at the two ends, as it were, bookending the block in the long dimension, with a gap between them of low-rise, street-oriented development, built form of typically up to 4 stories maximum. And that's the reason for that, because the policy tries to maintain and enhance livability and minimize things like overshadowing and privacy impacts and overlook and, of course, view blockage between the towers. So we try and keep a minimum dimension open between the towers to maintain the sense of openness and spaciousness, and also to allow for people, as it were, in the next row to look between the two towers and to get a bit of a view of the distant mountains and sea.
In Vancouver, as you said, so many of the vistas are terminated with trees, mountains, water, just gorgeous. But you've also managed to bring water and trees and even green lawns dotting every block. That is also by design?
Yes, it is largely, although there's a kind of a strange impulse that goes on around that, I've observed in Vancouver. It's almost as if we can't leave well enough alone when we finish designing the building, that we've then got to kind of cover it up with a sort of a vanity screen of landscaping literally on top of the buildings. And I've always found that quite amusing, but I guess also quite questionable, that we need to, we have this urge, this impulse collectively to literally decorate our buildings with trees and landscaping sort of dripping off of it. I have a bit of a problem with that. I think that, frankly, you cannot replicate the real natural landscape in all of its grandeur and splendor without trivializing it on buildings. And so I would rather see the buildings stand alone on their own merits, do the appropriate landscaping on the ground at grade around the base and the skirt of the building, and then let the context speak for itself, and as well as the building speak for themselves. Another factor in, I think, what you're referring to is that with this policy of towers on podiums, and the podiums being, you know, 2 to 4 stories, you have a large area of flat roof on top of these podiums, which the towers are looking down on. So there, I think there is a legitimate case to be made for addressing what would otherwise potentially be a fairly barren landscape on the top of the podiums that people will be looking down on and through, and to landscape those up. And so we're seeing that, and we're also seeing that space reclaimed as semi-private open space for the residents of the particular development, so they can actually go down there or at least visually enjoy it from their apartment above, which I think is an interesting approach.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Lance Borelowitz. He is author of Dream City, Vancouver, and the Global Imagination. When I was there recently, Lance, I visited on Good Friday, and a number of the smaller shops were closed. There weren't that many people on the street, even by mid-afternoon. Is that typical?
I think one of the curious things about Vancouver is that although and despite the significant intensification of the residential population in the downtown peninsula, at least, it still feels relatively unpopulated or uncongested, in my opinion. I just got back from a trip to Barcelona in Spain where, you know, we don't have anything near the kind of intensity of congestion on the streets, of people in the streets in Vancouver as you do in a city such as Barcelona. So we've managed to do a number of things pretty well in that regard, I think, in Vancouver. We've managed to, at the same time, densify the inner city whilst still maintain a high quality of amenity in the public realm by extending the public realm, and by that I mean publicly accessed open space around the perimeter, around the edge, the water's edge of the downtown peninsula. And so we tend to disperse the intense nodes of pedestrian traffic, the pedestrian volumes. And so you tend not to sense that high density when you walk around the city.
I was surprised to find that the route from the airport to downtown was not an expressway. Mm-hmm. Instead, it was a beautiful city street with residential punctuated every 4 or 5 blocks, maybe with shopping and commercial development on the corners. Is that typical of Vancouver city streets?
Well, the issue of the missing freeway or expressway is part of Vancouver's sort of self-mythology that we said no to urban freeways back in the late 60s, early 70s. And there's a whole story around that that I tell in the book, in Dream City, when local groundswell of opposition to an urban freeway basically stopped it in its tracks and the federal government backed off. And that's certainly something that Vancouver certainly can take some credit for. There are really no urban freeways within the city of Vancouver itself, although you do see some regional freeway system at the edges, at the periphery of the metropolitan area, beyond the city of Vancouver itself. But what you were describing, this sense of a green street right through the center of the city, one of the that's very typical of Vancouver, and you could have chosen any one of a number of streets and had that similar experience, punctuated, as you say, with these little nodes or intersections of local retail shopping. That's very much part of the ecology of Vancouver. And I use the word ecology in its broadest sense, the components that make up a place, an organism. One of the things that contributes to that, of course, quite simply, is Vancouver's climate. This is a rainforest. We're in the temperate Pacific Northwest rainforest. And so as a consequence, vegetation grows extremely quickly here and tends to be very green all year round. We have a lot of rain, as is well known about Vancouver. It's a very moist, humid climate. And so we don't have the desert-like conditions, say, of the Pacific South, the Southwest of the United States, for example, or the interior. It's not a continental climate. It's a maritime temperate rainforest climate. And so hedges and trees and landscaping grows very quickly, and it's very lush, and it stays green pretty much all year round. And that's certainly something that you can't fail to notice upon visiting Vancouver for the first time. The other piece of that you talked about is this these little neighborhood shopping centers that at key intersections and along key arterial routes through the city, which, by the way, track the former streetcar routes through Vancouver, we do have a tradition of local neighborhood stores and services, restaurants, cafes, coffee shops, and so on. And we've been very careful in Vancouver not only to protect those, but in fact to nurture them and enhance them. And we very much see Vancouver as a city of neighborhoods, several dozen neighborhoods of that kind. And so what you were doing in driving, I'm presuming, up Granville Street from the airport into downtown Vancouver was that you were crossing those. You were intersecting with several of those neighborhood arterial streets at right angles to them, and you were experiencing them briefly as you crossed through them.
What effect will the 2010 Olympic Winter Games have on the city?
Well, I'm one of those who actually thinks less effect than more. One of the reasons for that is because, and perhaps this is not as widely known as it should be, but the Winter Olympic Games, which is of course what we have landed for 2010, are substantially smaller than the Summer Olympic Games that, for example, the city of Barcelona and Sydney have hosted in Atlanta in recent years. Those games are much, much more significant in terms of the logistics and the scale and the scope of the games and the number of people that need to attend. The Winter Games are first of all, much smaller. They're an order of magnitude smaller than the Summer Games, and so by definition, I think their impacts are relatively smaller than the Summer Games. Secondly, again, by its very nature, a Winter Olympics tends to be dispersed between several venues. And in the case of Vancouver, most of the venues, at least a half of the venues, are in fact not in the city of Vancouver at all, but are up in Whistler Blackcomb, where many of the alpine and skiing and jumping, the snow-related events will be happening. And that's well over 100 miles from Vancouver. So you can imagine that those impacts really will not be felt very much in Vancouver. Having said that, certainly there are transportation impacts that we are already feeling. We're already seeing significant investment in public transportation infrastructure, highways and roadways that are connecting the various venues, and also in public transit infrastructure between the airport, downtown Vancouver, and downtown Richmond, which is a suburb just to the south of Vancouver, which will have the one of the skating oval venue for the Olympics. So I guess on balance what I'm saying is there will be localized impacts at certain areas where specific facilities are being built in the city, the most significant of which I think is the Athletes Village that is being built in Vancouver on the southeast side, the southeast shores of False Creek, and that will hopefully turn into a demonstration model of sustainable development in the center of the city. But other than that and a few other localized impacts, I think that the games are going to come and go, and before we know it, they'll be over.
Mm-hmm. What can other cities learn from Vancouver?
Well, that's the million-dollar question that you've asked and that I try to answer in my book, Dream City, because there's an endless stream of American academics, planners, architects, politicians pouring through Vancouver and shepherded around town by their local equivalents, showing off our city and the results. And there's lots to show off, and we're very proud of it and excited about it. But I and others like me do actually worry that you can't simply translate what we've done in Vancouver to other cities, to other cultures, to other political environments across Canada, let alone the United States of America. And I think there's a particular set of circumstances, both physical and cultural and political and economic, that pertain in Vancouver that have resulted in what we're calling now the Vancouver model. How much of that is transferable, say, to a Houston or a Chicago or a Detroit? I have my doubts, and others like me are beginning to really doubt that. You can sort of translate it in a very superficial level. You know, the form of development, maybe you can put that into a Toronto or somewhere else. But there are many factors that have contributed towards the Vancouver that you see today. And those factors need to be in place and in balance in a similar way in those other cities in order to produce the same results. And clearly, the city of Vancouver is very different from any other city in the world, as are all cities. So my answer is come and look at what we've done. Learn about both the successes and also the failures in Vancouver, because by no means is it only a 100% success story. There are many things that I think we could have done differently given a chance. But certainly take back what you can from the idea of reinvesting in your public realm, which I think Vancouver has done extremely well, recognizing that it's not just the private sector but also the public sector that has a role to play in that at all levels of government. Recognizing that density is, in fact, in all of our interests. Higher density and more compact mixed-use development, in fact, creates a more sustainable and ultimately a more healthy society. And Vancouver is very much trying to do that, at least at the center, although at the periphery we've had much less success. So I think there's some very important planning and design lessons that Vancouver can offer the world, so long as the lessons are filtered through that local filter, if you like, of what's doable in the city that the person coming here is from.
Lance, thanks for joining us on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lance Borelowitz is author of Dream City, Vancouver and the Global Imagination. Each week, CityView's commentator Walker Smith brings us his very personal look at life in cities.
I have my life down to two devices, a Palm phone and a video iPod, plus the laptop it takes to manage them. My calendar, contacts, and email are on my Palm phone. With my video iPod, I've got music, NPR podcast, and Law & Order. And when TiVo To Go ships its release for video iPods, I'll be able to transfer the latest episodes of West Wing to my iPod library. Who needs the old media anymore? I've got TV, radio, movies, CDs, Rolodex, phone, you name it, all rolled into one. Well, into two, actually. Still, everything I need is on two devices that if I stuff them in neatly, I can literally get into one back pocket. Of course, truth be told, I have yet to take the final plunge. I haven't sent my TV or stereo or DVD player to Goodwill, but it's just a matter of time before I completely discard the technologies of old. Whenever I think about this, I'm overwhelmed by the changes that technologies are bringing about. I remember the first family to get a color TV in our neighborhood in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I was in the second grade, and a group of us used to go to their house every afternoon to watch. Now I'm not even sure I need a TV. Except during basketball season, that is. The one flaw with my video iPod is that I can't tune in live to North Carolina basketball games. That's UNC, as in the University of National Champions, 2005, 1993, 1982, 1957, 1924. Yep, I'm a Tar Heel. 3 degrees and 10 years on campus. All too often when I'm traveling on business, I'm stuck overnight in some faraway city where nobody appreciates what UNC stands for. Instead of a Tar Heel game, there will be some other team on the local channel. So starting this year, I'm going to bring it with me. By hooking up a Sling Box to my TV, I can watch the Tar Heel game being shown on my TV at home using my laptop and the high-speed internet connection in my hotel room. Even when shopping these days, I don't have to waste time with salespeople. If I'm trying to decide which TV or appliance to buy, I can flip open my Palm phone and get access to ShopSmart, a new Consumer Reports website. Right there when I need it are ratings, comparisons, and articles. Unbiased information and recommendations at my fingertips. Now, I don't mean to sound like a product endorser, because I'm not. It's just that I'm in awe of the ways in which technologies are rapidly weaning us from anything we've ever known as advertising, media, news, or programming. My advice to all of my fellow 50-somethings is to get on board quickly, because we're only a decade away from a world in which everything we take for granted today will have gone away. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to find links to more information on what you heard today, sign up for podcasts and our weekly newsletter, and find archive shows. Smart City's web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders, with information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that trigger lasting change to improve the future of Memphis and its citizens. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm your host, Carol Coletta.